Just because you can do it on the internet doesn't mean you should, like preschool. Yep, online preschool. It seems like a good idea if you're a tech company looking to line your pockets. Pretty bad idea in reality. We will talk to a pediatrician who is also a librarian about the insane cost to both your pockets and your children. Let's bust some pencils.
This is Busted Pencils Radio, fully leaded education talk with Dr. Tim Slecker. Here's what's trending in education news.
From Forbes.com, six education stories to watch in 2020. It's the week we all get out either the rearview mirrors or the crystal balls. Let's grab the crystal. Here are six education stories to watch for the coming year and how to read them.
Only six? It's the only...
This is all we're going to talk about.
This is Peter Green. Been a guest. We talk about his stuff. Education comes out of Forbes, though, and he's got six things, though, that he thinks are going to be really important. I want to go through them real quickly, and then we'll kind of hit them a little bit. So, number one, EdTech is going to try to grow its market.
Well, of course it will.
Yes. Student surveillance will be on the rise.
Creepy.
Really creepy. Personalized learning products will flood the market. Still not sure what it means to personalize your learning.
Right.
Hey, we're still not going to know what to do about the fact that nobody wants to teach. The accountability pendulum will swing. I'm not so sure about that one. And hey, last but not least, Betsy DeVos will continue to be a pain in our behind.
Doesn't seem like a story.
That doesn't seem like a story. I think that you can bet all your money on that one coming true.
Right.
Because that's a guarantee. But so first, EdTech trying to grow its market. What does that actually mean?
I was confused by that too, because I always think EdTech, so I think tablets and gaming systems to make kids learn,
right,
that kind of thing. Of course that's going to grow, isn't it?
Right. Well, because, and that flows into, and we'll mix that one with personalized learning, because this idea that technology companies in education now, where we used to say, let's sell schools textbooks so teachers can use textbooks.
Right.
Now we've entered the form of going, no, let's sell kids, as you said, tablets, devices, software, anything that can, quote, supposedly inspire learning. Right. With screen time, which we're going to talk about that one a little bit later. So, and this is all going to be personalized. The problem is that I've never met an algorithm that knows me.
You said they're doing it wrong.
They're doing it wrong. Now, maybe AI, and I heard some stuff with Elon Musk over the break, but I'm not sure about that one. Student surveillance. How is this one going to be on the rise? Because here's the deal. Every time you as a college, for example, if you're applying to a college and you apply online right now, your data is out there. So it's like everything else. And guess what? Companies, ed tech companies again, going to be watching the crap out of who's playing with what ed technology.
Okay.
Teachers, yes. Why would there not be a problem with this? Because no one's put forward any solution that makes teaching better.
But here's the thing. Everyone knows the problem. I mean, the problem isn't this big thing. Nobody's like, well, I don't know why they're not doing this. Why don't teachers want to stay in?
Knowing the problem and fixing the problem are two different things.
True. That's
okay?
True.
Because some people like the problem. For example, though, they move down where Peter says the accountability pendulum will swing. If that's true, then I think teaching does move in a better direction. This is why I don't really see the accountability. The idea that teachers are failures still has to remain true for those in power to continue to stay in power, and for those who sell ed technology to stay in business, need teachers to be stupid because technology will replace stupid teachers.
Got it.
Okay? Okay. And then, yes, last but not least, Betsy, my God, Betsy. Hey, just throw this in there, though. It's an interesting thing to watch as we come forward, though. There is a judge that has ruled that on her oversight of student loan forgiveness, that she may have broken the law.
From NPR.org, Virginia School District to give students one day off per year for civic engagement. One of the largest school districts in the country is trying something new. Starting next month, students in Fairfax County, Virginia can take one day off per school year to engage in political activism.
One day a year to engage in political activism, and we're celebrating this? Is this a celebratory story, or is this a, wow, it's gotten really bad.
Or maybe they're just sick of marking the kids absent. They go.
Okay. It's coming out of NPR, and if you read the entire story, which I, you know, there'll be a link in the show and you can check it out, but there's kind of this celebratory nature that a school district has stepped up and said, you know what, we're going to give students a day off a year for civic engagement, because the foundation of American public schools is democratic participation. Okay? Yes. Quickly, there's the article, right?
Right.
One day?
Just one.
Just one. So all those other 179 days, if something happens that might burst my curiosity of civic engagement, I have to measure out and go, you know what, I better wait because I don't know if something better's coming later, because I only get one day to be civically engaged a year.
Right. Okay. Hold on to that one day till fourth quarter, kids.
So, you know, recognizing the importance of being engaged as a student, as a high school student, and seeing these things and saying, yes, we should make space for that. Well, of course. The idea, though, that we're going to quantify that in a single day and that students might have to be forced to, quote, pick and choose, that's really not civic engagement. In fact, civic engagement, if you look at, sometimes comes out of the result of a current event that happens right away.
Yep, very true.
And guess what happens 4 months later? Another thing happens, okay? The idea that you only get one day a year, instead of saying civic engagement should be central to the curriculum, that's what I would like to see as a real policy, civic engagement every day.
From EdSurge.com, the answer for schools is not more technology, it's teachers and human connection.
No way.
Really, it says so right here.
Teachers and human connections and not technology connections?
I know.
Who would have thought? Wait, they obviously didn't listen to the first story about the trends about ed technology going to be going for its market share. No, this is nice to finally hear this, because this is the reality. Can technology in a classroom be something supportive for teachers? The answer is yes.
For sure.
Okay, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like, look, go back to the blackboard and white chalk.
Right.
Okay? That's all you need. And McGuffey readers. Okay? No. You know, as things come, we're willing to do it. But the idea that we've seen pushing forward more and more and more is more kids in front of screens and less time in front of people, mm-hmm. both their peers and with teachers. The reality of that is that it's not really that great of a model. Kids, particularly young kids, of which we're going to talk about in the main interview later, putting kids in front of a screen is not a substitute for education. It doesn't work that way. Kids need people.
Mm-hmm.
Do you decide?
I totally agree. And what really scared me with this article was that they said there was a charter school that said they rely on this type of technology for teaching kids, and they can serve 630 students with 6 teachers and aides.
There you go. See?
What is that?
Well, that's the model, though, right? We're talking
crazy.
About it's an efficiency thing. Guess what? If you have Chromebooks in front of 50 students, then you don't need 2 teachers for 25. You need 1 teacher who can come across in the Chromebook and deliver the lessons. Or not to pick on Chromebook, it could be an iPad,
it could be
your phone, whatever it is, right? Sure. But when you hear that, you go, okay, so the reality is that you're replacing the human connection.
Right.
And whether they're 18 or whether they're 3, children, people, teachers need human connections, because teaching and learning is about a relationship. And I've not seen a good relationship with a computer that worked out well. He is an associate professor of pediatrics at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. He's a pediatrician working in the public interest. He blends the roles of physician, occasional children's librarian, educator, public health professional, and child health advocate. Welcome to Busted Pencils, Dr. Dipesh Navsaria.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
You know, I've been lucky to hear you speak at different events, But the article that came up that we're going to talk about very specifically, this $1.5 million for online preschool is what I really want to get deep into. But a medical doctor, pediatrics, and a librarian. How does that happen first?
Let's just say none of that was actually planned, at least in the long term. It kind of was an interesting scenic route. What I'll say is that it was in the middle of medical school that I went and got a library degree, specifically because I wanted to learn more about children's books and children's literature from my interest in Reach Out and Read, which is a pediatric early literacy program that we do through medical clinics that I'm the founding medical director of in Wisconsin.
So what did you learn about children's literature?
Well, I learned so much about the richness of children's literature, about what goes into good quality books versus not so good quality books, about what is it that speaks to children, and also about the elements of books that are useful in terms of thinking about children's development over time. I was an English major as an undergraduate, honestly, so literary analysis and all is familiar to me,
right,
but not so much on the children's side.
Okay, because I was going to mention the literature. I saw that, too, in your background, so I was thinking there had to be an intersection there. So now, though, the combination, this is what, you know, in fact, one of the places where I saw you speaking was, in fact, using good children's literature when working with and creating that bond between caregiver and child, and how the book, that mm-hmm. medium, helps facilitate that bond. Is there mm-hmm. something medically researchable that we can say, yeah, of course you do that.
Yeah. Oh, there's oodles of research. I mean, we could easily spend hours talking about that, and maybe someday we should.
Right.
What I would say is that, you know, it's not so much about teaching children to read early, and it's not even so much about the book to a certain extent. What I tell people is Reach Out and Read. People think we're a book giveaway. They think it's a literacy program. And yeah, it's those things. But we're actually secretly a parenting support program. What we're trying to do is create those moments to create a scaffold, in a sense, for high quality responsive interactions between a parent and a child. And sharing a book together and helping a parent be successful and confident in sharing their book with their young child is really what we're aiming for. Because if that happens almost every night at home, we know that there's great benefits from there. And we have great neurological evidence for that. Wonderful brain imaging studies coming out of University of Cincinnati, the Children's Hospital there, and all sorts of other things showing what a great benefit there is to doing that shared book reading, those responsive interactions.
Okay. So now, the article, though, that came out in the Cap Times that I really wanted to talk to you about, because you're quoted in here, is the possibility of providing up to $1.5 million for an online preschool program for kids in rural and or urban poverty settings. And you hear a lot in this article about, well, it's just, we want to see if this is something that can benefit the achievement gap. Mm-hmm. And I always try to unbundle the achievement gap as being some of the things you talked about is, you know, but your concern, when I look at this, though, when I talk about four-year-olds and younger being put in front of an online preschool program, what's the first response as a pediatrician that you have?
So I would say whenever we're met with an extraordinary kind of claim like this, right, mm-hmm. that online preschool is something that could benefit children, I say, fine, I hope you have extraordinary evidence to show that this works, right?
Right.
I don't want to just dismiss it out of hand and say there's no way, but yeah, my eyebrow certainly does go up and say, really? Okay, what's the evidence for that? There's a couple of issues here. One is some of the claims being made are really around kind of almost like a drills and skills type mm-hmm. approach, right? Look, we can teach this child colors. We can teach them letters. We can teach them numbers. We can do these things where we can show something to them and they can recognize it. That's not really what preschool is all about, though. I think it's a byproduct of preschool that mm-hmm. we want children who are exposed to preschool or to reading at home with their parents or anything else, right? They will pick up what letters are, numbers, colors, et cetera, as a byproduct. But a lot of what goes on in preschool is also about socio-emotional learning. And, you know, I have to say, people get a little confused, right? What is socio-emotional development?
Help us understand that.
Yeah. So here's the shorthand way I put it when I was asked recently for to do a brief video. And they said, what does socio-emotional development mean to you? I say, well, gross motor skills is what helps you learn how to walk. Fine motor skills is what leads you to be able to pick things up or write eventually. Speech and language skills are what help you be able to speak and express yourself. Socio-emotional development helps you know when you should and shouldn't use those other skills, right? It's kind of that regulator that helps us know when is it appropriate to do these things in society, when is it not, what are the nuances I need to do and know to pick up from other people about what are their feelings, what are their attitudes, etc. That's a lot of what happens early on. It starts from birth, really. And a lot of what we do in preschool are things like patience, turn-taking, sharing, you know, and that all sounds kind of cute in a certain way, but my goodness, these are skills we need for our entire adult life. Like right now, you're doing an excellent job of turn-taking and waiting until I'm done speaking, right? Right. This is what we need.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
I've been practicing. Sometimes I just need to practice not hitting send on the email sometimes, because that's obviously, I miss part of that socio-emotional. But I want to talk, though, too, a little bit more specifically from the medical side and a pediatrician. We hear about this screen time issue, and it's not really deep in this article about this. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think it's kind of pushed aside with this. Mm-hmm. Well, it's only 15 minutes a day. Mm-hmm. But again, we're talking about 4-year-olds, 3-year-olds, 2-year-olds. What do you say as a medical doctor, though, about screen time, mm-hmm. just in general for children, mm-hmm. and young children at that developmental 2, 3, 4 years old? Good, bad, indifferent. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's the way we're going, so they may as well get used to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, far from it on that last one.
Okay.
What I'll say is the way we've been talking about it has also evolved. So I'll start with, you know, we used to have, not all that long ago, the American Academy of Pediatrics guidelines said, no screen time under 2, no more than 2 hours a day, older than 2. The thing is, that's kind of like saying book time or paper time, right? The content matters. What are you watching, right? Are you watching videos that are filled with quick scene changes, bright colors, et cetera, that are meant to keep you watching? Which, by the way, we do to older kids and adults, too. I mean, if you look at one of the latest phenomenons for older kids is TikTok, right? It's very quick changes, very short. It's designed to like kind of keep you, gravitated towards it. And some have argued that it's actually doing harm to our attention spans over time.
Right.
So I think what's actually being watched and how screens are being used is actually a bigger issue. Okay. Now, the problem is I don't have a short, quick, pithy way to convey that to parents. And that's one of the challenges. So we talk a lot about a lot of elements like, no screens at mealtimes or in the room at night or at bedtime or things like that. But the main thing is, what is your child actually doing on the screen? And I think that's why that didn't really come out in this article, is that, if somebody wants to show me extraordinary benefit to a child that from this sort of a program and it's delivered on a screen, that's okay, in a sense.
Okay.
But the evidence has to be there.
Right.
So it's not that spending time in front of a screen in and of itself, just the screen, is going to do something bad to your brain. Okay. There are some strange ideas out there about eye development and all that. There's a little evidence for, but not much.
Okay.
And I'm a little skeptical on that. But the main issue is the time they're spending on a screen, whether it's quote unquote educational software that the parents download or this program, or watching cartoons or whatever, is that displacing other types of activities that we know are beneficial? As one of my colleagues says, screen time steals real time.
Well, and I think that's where, too, when I look at this program specifically, because we look at and say, who's it going to? Mm-hmm. And it very specifically says rural, urban, kids in poverty. Mm-hmm. And so right away, that'll, for me as an educator, says there's a deficit model thinking of already thinking that urban poverty, kids in the rural poverty are at some kind of deficit and need some kind of fixing. And when we first started talking about just your introduction to books, and I look at $1.5 million being invested into screen time for what amounts to about 700 kids at most, it seems like from this article, I'm sitting there thinking about, well, as you just said, screen time 15 minutes or book time 15 minutes with high quality books. What could $1.5 million do for 600 kids in book time?
So what I will say is, for example, reach out and read Wisconsin, because I know our numbers well. We are currently touching the lives of 1 in 3 children in Wisconsin under age 5. Okay, and we're doing that with a whole 3.5 FTEs of staff. And
it's full-time equivalency for the listener out there.
Thank you. 264 clinics throughout the state that are participating, and we actually have a waiting list of more clinics that want to join. And the only reason we can't add more clinics is we don't have the staff to provide the proper technical assistance, the training, so that the staff understand how to engage with families on this, what sorts of advice to give, how to problem solve and see what sort of barriers there may be for parents to, you know, it's one thing, we could just put up billboards, right, saying read to your kid, and we do that.
Sure.
We already do that. But if a parent isn't confident in what they're doing, or they're not sure how to engage their young squirmy toddler in what we call dialogic reading, that back and forth over a book that works really well with a toddler who has a naturally short attention span, okay, that's what we need. For $1.5 million, I could do a whole lot with Reach Out and Read Wisconsin for many more kids.
Okay.
But at the same time, I want to be careful about also not saying, gee, this is one small pot of money, and now we're going to argue over which program is most deserving. I would argue that we actually need to make the pot bigger so that we have a variety of supports. Mm-hmm. And again, if the evidence for this program that's being proposed is solid, then I have no problem with it being added on to other things like home visiting, like Reach Out and Read, and so on. But again, for that price tag, the evidence better be really good, because what I worry is that it's pulling us away from the conversation that we really should be having, which is, why aren't we putting money into what we know works, which is high quality, traditional early childhood education programs in all of these areas?
That's it. When you say an add-on versus what should be there, when we're talking about this play-based human interactions, and in one way, you know, the monetary cost is you know, $1.5 million. Like you just said, what, holy crap, what can I do with that? But I really think hard too about saying, yeah, you know, we don't want to take away opportunities to engage families and children in things that are coming up that are innovative that might be there. But when I get to the bottom of the article, again, it comes back to saying poor kids in rural and urban areas have an achievement gap, and this is going to fix it. Mm-hmm. And I go right to the group Waterford, who it is, and I look in it, and, you know, it's a quote nonprofit, which again, we have to explain to people, doesn't mean they don't make money, because everybody there has to get paid. And I looked at their board and I went through everything and I said, this looks to me like a technology company that's trying to say, we've got a solution to what ails you. Wisconsin, you have the largest achievement gap in the 50 states, supposedly. Mm-hmm. Buy this from us. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And as an educator, somebody who's worked in this field, I've been trying to get out the message, careful when a private company and a legislator or legislators get together and say, we've found a solution for the education problem.
And you know, what I'll say is it's even more than just education. We, as a society, we like this idea of the cheap, easy solution, like the magic fix, like this is the thing that will kind of handle everything. So let's take it away from education for one brief moment.
Sure.
We have a huge disparity, racial disparity in Wisconsin in infant mortality, right? That also goes along with a lot of the education issues, but all. So there's this idea of this thing called a baby box. Okay, it's a cardboard box that is filled with baby supplies, and they do this in Finland and some other nations. They deliver this box to parents of newborn babies. It's filled with supplies, and the box itself has a thin mattress at the bottom. So once you've emptied all the supplies, your baby can sleep in this box. It's like a small cradle. And everyone says, oh, look, Finland had this high infant mortality rate in 1950-something, and they rolled out baby boxes, and now it's among the lowest in the world, and so on. And they think the baby box is magically going to fix infant mortality. Well, Finland also did a whole bunch of other things. Oh, universal health care, home visiting nurses, an amazing social safety net, you know, that's universal.
Time off,
you know,
parents.
Tons of paid time off, parental leave, all those things, right? Those are the things that actually move the needle. It's not just the darn box.
Right.
But
the baby box itself actually sounds pretty cool because it's
cool and all. I will point out the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission has not evaluated any of those boxes as a safe infant
surface. I was going to say, I can hear somebody out there going, you're putting kids in boxes?
Yeah. Right? I mean, probably, my guess is they're probably okay. But again, no one's done a formal evaluation in terms of safety.
Right.
But the box is not going to fix homelessness. The box is not going to fix racism. The box is not going to fix discrimination. The box is not going to fix the lack of a living wage. It's not going to fix lack of paid parental leave, et cetera, et cetera. But we like it because it's inexpensive. And you can say, wow, we could distribute 10,000 boxes with almost no money. Text messaging programs are another one. It's not that I think text messaging programs don't have useful, valid information in them. But as Professor Ariel Khalil, who's a public policy professor at the University of Chicago, said, you're not going to text a family out of homelessness. Right. So I worry that this feels like another cheap, easy, but ultimately ineffectual fix.
Right.
And it's not a lot of money, but at the same time, it is a lot of money, depending on where you want to apply that money.
Right.
And the other thing I'll say is that it's still distracting from why don't we have good, high-quality early childhood education universally available to every community in our state?
And that is, you know, that's both. We asked that question on this show quite a bit, and you said we talked to Dr. Nancy Carlson Page, Matt Damon's mom, all the time about all the early childhood, defending the early years. We come at this and just say, you know, some form of universal quality preschool with people, caring adults, play-based activities, all of that. And, you know, why can't we invest in that when you say, show me the evidence? Mm-hmm. Well, the evidence there is overwhelming.
Yes.
That it works. And instead, as you said, we're going to, in one way, and this reminds me of this book that I just read, and I can't think of the author's last name, first, Winners Take All. It's this whole idea of philanthropy with big technology trying to fix problems. But, you know, when I look at this, it's like seed money for this technology company for 600 students. And as you pointed out, of those students, and I've said this a million times, if three of those students are homeless in February, getting a device with 15 minutes of preschool planning on it, what for?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so, yeah, I'm maybe cynical is the word. I get cynical when I see politicians and tech companies come together to put together educational solutions, mm-hmm. because it seems to me not just a distraction, but an intentional distraction away from issues of poverty, mm-hmm. racism, homelessness, the socioeconomic mm-hmm. inequities that mm-hmm. we allow to continue going forward. That's my statement. Mm-hmm. I don't know where you're at on that, but I've just been, every education solution never comes from the idea of saying, we're dealing with an issue of some form of poverty reduction, socioeconomic inequalities, homelessness, medical, and we know those move the needle, but we're not willing. In all your time practicing, and I've heard you say this, when are we going to say the evidence is overwhelming?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we've said that, but how do we move that needle to say we're ready to invest?
Right. I think that, you know, look, early childhood should not be a partisan issue, right? That we, everyone, including our entire legislature, were young children once, you know. I think it is very hard, and this is actually goes across the political spectrum. I think it is very hard for people who grew up with relative comfort, education, people around them who loved and cared and nurtured them and so on, to recognize that not reading to your child is probably not a moral deficit, right? It's not a lack of caring or wanting. That there's a lot of things that can get in the way. One may be your own literacy skills from, you know, a system that often graduates people that may not be able to read well. And you can go back into the roots of why that is. It can be the fact that someone may want to know how to read to their kid, may know how to read to their kid, and they can't because they're working a second job because of the lack of a living wage. They might not have the confidence, right? So a lot of parents of toddlers, I referenced this earlier, will say, my toddler doesn't like being read to anymore. Because what they're doing is they're reading exactly what it says on the page, which works great if you're in third or fourth grade and told to read out loud.
Right.
But it doesn't work for a two-year-old, you know, or an 18-month-old. That kid is squirmy. So talk about the pictures. Make it a game. Go backwards. I'm not going to make you write an essay on what the story is, right? You know,
there's no right way to read a book when you're two.
Yeah. So here's the thing. You can't text or even demonstration videos and all are really hard for a parent to understand how to do that dialogic reading well if it's not been modeled for them. Mm. Versus if you have a home visitor, or if you're doing the clinic for your child's regular checkup and it's a reach out and read clinic, and we talk and model and coach and say, yes, you're doing it right. Right? See, that's the thing. With all the technology out there, it doesn't have a way to respond to your unique needs. That screen is not going to read your child or read you as a parent and say, huh, you look a little concerned about that. You seemed skeptical. Oh, I like how you did that, right? It's not going to give you that feedback. And the thing is, that's how we as human beings learn. I mean, I talk about this all the time when we educate medical students, right? I mean, medical students want to hear, you're on the right track. I think you did a good job with that patient. Here's some ways I think you can maybe improve for next time. And then when they do it, you say, great, I like how you learned how to do that, right? We all thrive on this, including highly educated professionals. And right. We don't assume that, what do you mean you don't know how to take a patient history? Isn't that easy? You know,
right.
Why is parenting any different? And why is education any different?
So we come look at this then, and yeah, this high quality early childhood. And I like the part that you're throwing in, though, the importance of actually the fact that some of the parenting part that goes with it is also something that we might need to take some time and have some education. Your organization, can people, if they're interested, is there a website they can go to?
Mm-hmm. For Reach Out and Read nationally, there's the reachoutandread.org. It's all one word.
Reachoutandread.org. Mm-hmm. One word.
One word.
Okay.
Or if you just Google Reach Out and Read Wisconsin, mm-hmm. it'll take you to the page of the Wisconsin affiliate. Tons of information on there about the Reach Out and Read model, about our scope nationally as well as in Wisconsin. I'm on the board of National Center as well, so if any of your listeners are from out of state, they can certainly look up their local affiliates.
All 50 states. Actually, we have a couple listeners in Finland.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I don't know that we have Reach Out and Read operational in Finland. But
it doesn't sound like they need it, though. They're
Think everyone can use it, and right. If they'd like to have me fly out to Helsinki and they have some funding, let me know.
Actually, we'll both go.
There you go.
You know, I think. And then for just your stuff, it's NavSaria.com, Navsaria.com to mm-hmm. check out. Mm-hmm. Dr. Navsaria.
And I have several links on there, by the way, to my public-facing social media, Facebook, Twitter, which is where most of the action is. The website's just a convenient way to get there.
Anything else you want to throw out there for any where they should, you know,
gosh,
we're going to talk about
yeah.
defending the early years. Yeah. I really do want to have you back to talk mm-hmm. more specifically about the parenting aspect. Mm-hmm. I think that mm-hmm. could be a really deep conversation. Mm-hmm. The screen time, yeah, we can get a lost on this. But, you know, thanks for the resources. Thanks for your time. And mm-hmm. most importantly, thank you for busting pencils.
You're welcome.
Hey, this is Tim from Rise Against here on Busted Pencils Radio.
Time now for our weekly salute to legendary historian and activist Howard Zinn. This is your moment of Zinn.
Human history is not only of cruelty, but also of compassion, sacrifice, courage, kindness. What we choose to emphasize in this complex history will determine our lives.
My thanks to my guest, Dr. Dipesh Nafsaria. Remember, subscribe, rate, and share Busted Pencils. I'm Dr. Tim Slecker. Thank you for busting pencils.
Log on to BustedPencils.com for the latest trending news, blogs, past shows, and more. Subscribe to our podcast in iTunes and Google Play. And get daily updates by following us on Facebook and Twitter at Busted Pencils. This is Fully Leaded Education Talk. Busted Pencils Radio.